From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for Easter weekend 2019. The Dodgers are in town for a weekend series with the Brewers. The Bucks playoffs continue in Detroit, and it's Easter weekend. The holiest day on the Christian calendar means brunch, Easter eggs, jelly beans, and getting your picture taken with a 5-foot-tall rabbit. Well, an Oregon woman dialed 911 about a burglary in progress, and the burglar is still in her bathroom. The cops showed up in force, broke down the bathroom door, and came face-to-face with a killer Roomba. You know, the robotic vacuum. Responding to the false alarm, one of the cops was heard to say, "This sucks." Just a little vacuum cleaner humor. And finally, talk about irony, a Detroit police officer is the focus of an internal investigation. He allegedly showed up drunk to a Michigan State Police training class. The class was focused on the use of a breathalyzer. In the studio today, we have Mark Amateus, Adam Bailey, Joel Dreesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Yeah, thank you. Stocks remain range-bound this week as they pressed up against the recent highs set in September of last year. Economic data for the week was generally positive, with continued strength in the labor market and strong retail sales. And China, the world's second-largest economy, reported better-than-expected GDP numbers, coming in at 6.4% for the first quarter. The uptick was primarily due to increases in March retail sales and factory output. Meanwhile, healthcare stocks fell further behind the major indexes as Wednesday's trading saw the sector drop more than 2% as the topic of Medicare for All gained traction in the news cycle. The healthcare sector now lags the major indexes by 10 to 15%. Looking forward to next week when we'll have 134 of the S&P 500 constituents report earnings, and while expectations remain low, it'll be interesting to see where we head. For the week, the NASDAQ added 14 points, or 0.2%. The S&P 500 dropped 2 points, or 0.1%. And in the four-day week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 147 points, 110 of that today, to add 0.6%. For the year, the NASDAQ now up 20.9%, including dividends. The S&P 500 up 16.6%, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 14.6%. And the benchmark 10-year U.S. Treasury held steady on the week at 2.56%, down slightly from the start of the year, where we began at 2.69%. It's a quick look at the numbers, and I think with China, the U.S. taking steps this week towards a resolution on the trade deal, now talking about maybe by late May or June having things in place with economic data out of China pointing to maybe a little better growth than expected, with a host of economic data this week that pointed to kind of a continued slow growth story, the same story we've been talking about now for the better part of, almost a decade maybe when you go back to the financial crisis. Mark, Adam, I wonder what stands out to you this week.
I guess for me, it was the, tentative talk of a trade deal, maybe coming as soon as, or at least the ceremonial signing of it, maybe coming as soon as late May, early June. Nothing's guaranteed, of course, but I think that's going to be greeted with a sigh of relief from business communities, here in the United States, in Europe, and in China. And it's also going to go a long way to help alleviate what I think has been the single largest source of uncertainty that has weighed on the global markets. And you see China this week, they reported, like you said, 6.4% GDP growth, down a little bit from previous quarter, but held steady, better than estimates. A lot of their stimulative measures that they've been introducing over the past several months and quarters seemingly working. So it's good to see some positive news on that front.
Kyle, I think for me, it's a couple things. One being that this still seems to be the bull market, the recovery that just gets no respect. There's still a lot of caution out there amongst investors. There's still a lot of cash on the sidelines. Those are wonderful for a continued climb in the market. We talk about the saying that the market climbs a wall of worry. It's when everybody's optimistic, when everybody thinks the market's going to the moon and they're all in, that the market can't go any higher because everybody that wanted to be invested, is now fully invested, and that's far from where we're at right now. A couple other things that I think are real positive to me is the way the markets have kind of come together. You know, last year the overseas markets vastly underperformed the U.S. You know, the U.S. was down, but overseas markets down a lot more, talking 2018. And now this year, boy, some of the overseas markets are outperforming the U.S. as well as we're doing here. And in addition, the market is broadening a little bit. You know, last year in 2018, value stocks, large cap value stocks were down three times as much as large cap growth stocks were down. And now value stocks are up 75% of the gain of growth stocks. So that's really healthy for the market. It's broadening out. So, you know, I'm not sitting here predicting this bull market's going to go on forever. It obviously won't. But right now, I just see some real good signs amongst investors and psychology and the way the market is performing. Lastly, I would just say as well, volatility is low, you know. It just seems like there's some good things going on in the markets right now.
You know, Mark, I find it interesting you mentioned, you know, low volatility here this week, and, you know, in the markets in general, but overseas stocks had a really good week. You take a look at some of the export powerhouses, Germany, France, Japan, you know, broader Asia, they put together a pretty respectable week, even when not much was going on here in the markets.
And Adam, I think it's fair to point out that you look at much of Europe, and they've been beaten up pretty good in recent years, especially. And
talking in the crossfire between, you know, the trade war and us and China.
Yeah, for sure. And you add in the uncertainties of Brexit, and I think you had a lot of European companies really unsure of what their next steps were going to be. And we saw some data from Unilever this week, from Nestle this week, that maybe the emerging markets are helping out a little more than they had in the past. That you had, you know, some pretty significant uncertainties in Argentina. You had Brazil that had gone through quite a bit of an economic slowdown last year. And all of a sudden now, you know, maybe Argentina is still a problem, but all of a sudden Brazil's starting to pick up a little bit again. And some of the rest of the emerging world is contributing. And so, you know, I think it's incredibly interesting. You look at, you know, Mark, you mentioned kind of the divergence between sectors. And Adam, you mentioned kind of Europe contributing and some of the rest of the world contributing. You know, I think those are the areas where even if the U.S. should slow down a little bit, and we've talked about the prospects of an economic recession, and maybe in a bit we'll get to the other type of recession, this earnings recession that is likely on the table here, but we've talked about the prospects of that economic recession here, and I think the one saving grace is that while maybe we're fully valued as a market here, as a stock market, in much of the rest of the world, there's deals to be had. There's still discounts out there. And so, you know, that stuff's cheap for a reason. Certainly not telling investors that they need to rush out and buy that, you know, that Italian bank or, you know, any number of other stocks that might be out there that look cheap. Because, again, they're cheap for a reason. But some opportunities out there to be sure.
Well, and I think, you know, Kyle, you hit on a big part of the reason for the overseas markets doing better in a number of instances than we are here in the U.S. is just a valuation story. You know, their valuations are a lot lower than ours. But in addition, I think investors need to remember that when you talk about overseas stocks, you're really just talking about where the company is domiciled. It doesn't tell you anything about where they do their business, where they get their sales, revenues, and profits. You know, Johnson Controls, that was here, right here in Milwaukee, is now an Ireland company for the tax benefits. But you want to be diversified overseas for other reasons, currency issues, taxation issues. So, again, you want to make sure you've got that diversification in your portfolio.
You know, and also to point out that even if you own just, you know, the S&P 500 index, if you own a lot of U.S. businesses, so much of the revenue comes from overseas, comes from emerging markets. So it's not just, you know, if you own, you know, domestic businesses, it's only the U.S. economy. You have exposure to all corners of the globe.
And I think the one other thing for investors to remember in that regard is there's certain businesses you can't own just being a U.S. investor or just being a German investor or just being an Australian investor, that if you want exposure to certain types of companies, you know, in particular thinking of a lot of the technology stocks that really are just so focused in domicile here in the U.S., but with a global presence, things like Google, things like Facebook, you know, if you want to invest in those types of companies, the U.S. is the market for you. And at the same time, You know, there are other types of companies in other markets that I think, you know, as a U.S. investor or a U.S.-only investor, you otherwise might not be able to participate in. You know, I think one of the big things that we've talked about recently has been the prospects of an earnings recession. We got some data from FactSet today pointing to, you know, the decline in earnings in the first quarter greater than 4% now, but also looking at the second quarter and really now for the last couple of weeks seeing a decline on the table of maybe about 0.5% in earnings for the second quarter. And so, you know, I think just important to point out first and foremost that the idea of this earnings recession, it's not a new one. We've been talking now for a number of quarters about how earnings growth was going to slow down to start this year, that we'd probably see it pick back up at the end of the year. And I think the big difference now is we can point to those two consecutive quarters of forecast decline as a way to say that, yeah, the earnings recession probably is here. Important, however, to remember that a lot of that forecast is simply companies getting ahead of bad news, companies trying to get ahead of this idea that, you know, they are going to have something bad happen, that they don't want investors to be surprised. And so they're going to downgrade what their expectations are for earnings ahead of those actual releases. And so when you have very few of the S&P companies issuing any kind of real guidance, what really takes over is the few companies that you do have that are issuing that negative guidance. And so, you know, I think we typically see the worst of the earnings forecasts right at the start of the quarter. And then you start to see those releases and the actual earnings numbers tend to be considerably better. Maybe not enough for this first quarter to make it positive, but potentially for the second quarter, enough of a surprise to the upside to make that a positive number. And so, you know, with 150 of those companies reporting next week, with more of the 500 in the weeks to come, I think it'll be interesting to see how far we move from that. And then the other piece of this, you know, for investors to remember is that stocks are a forward-looking indicator. And so if we're concerned about where we currently are with earnings, I think important for investors to remember that maybe some of what we saw in the fourth quarter was an anticipation of this.
And also the market's looking forward to the next 6 months, the next 12 months. And you look at the third and fourth quarter, and earnings are expected to grow. We're not going to have the negative numbers. And the negative numbers really are just due to a one-time accounting gimmick, if you will, and to change in the tax law, which, you know, it's faded from now, or faded from then. But you look ahead to third and fourth quarter, earnings growth of 1.3% in third and 8.2% in the fourth, full on for the year. I mean, we're talking 3.4% earnings growth and revenue growth of 4.7%. So still respectable numbers at this point in the business cycle.
And Kyle, I think it's important to maybe explain to our listeners what an earnings recession is as opposed to an economic recession.
Hold up now. I'm not so sure there is a clear and official definition for an earnings recession. I actually went back and I checked all of my old economics textbooks, which had had a lot of, you know, dust over the last 15 plus years. I did not find earnings recession anywhere.
Well, what we want to point out is that it doesn't mean what the term recession usually means in our business, economic recession, two quarters of negative economic growth. We're talking about a decline in earnings over the previous year's quarter.
Decline in earnings
and,
growth.
Right, in earnings growth over the prior year's quarter. And that's not necessarily something to be as scared about as a recession in the economy, which is not what we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely, Mark, especially when you consider the technical issues with earnings growth that Adam talked about in terms of erasing the year-over-year tax benefit and some of the other issues that I think are one-offs. It's a very technical issue right now and certainly not does not have the same impact on the economy more broadly that a true recession would have. I mean, I think one of the things that weighs on this, though, is how valuable some of these forecasts really are. And I'm struck by a forecast from FactSet that takes all these analysts that looks at earnings. They combine those price targets that they're putting on companies into this idea that, you know, if you follow those analysts, the S&P should grow about 7.5%. You know, the underlying price of the S&P should grow about 7.5% over the next 12 months. And, you know, I think the challenge there, as with all of these other things, is the number of variables that go into predicting that. The other challenge when you're looking at these forecasts, and, you know, it's common for economists to put up forecasts on where the economy is headed, but especially when you're looking at kind of price targets and the direction for the markets more broadly, is that these are people who are cheerleaders for stocks. And so try to, as you're, you know, thinking through some of that as an investor, keep that in mind that, yeah, maybe FactSet's saying 7.5, but this is from people who tend to be about 1.5% more favorable than the markets actually end up being.
I want to put two points together that you just made, economic reports and earnings reports. I'm going to merge the two. Take a look at bank earnings this week, specifically consumer banks. You had the investment banks, they kind of had a ho-hum week, but consumer banks didn't. And that, I think, is an insight into the overall health and wellness of the economy, that core consumer lending and core consumer loans continue to grow and continue to be strong.
And Joel, we got some data on consumers this week and some data on employment this week. I wonder, you know, in particular, the retail sales number is a big one that stands out, the best number in a year and a half for retail sales growth. And, you know, that's really the underlying, you know, driver, the engine of this economy is how are those consumers doing? So I wonder what kinds of stuff you saw this week in the economic releases.
Right, Kyle. So, yeah, so we keep saying that, you know, consumers drive two-thirds or more of the gross domestic product. So, you know, that's a big part of our economic engine. And we had those numbers that came out today on Thursday for retail sales, and those were much better than expected, double what the analysts were forecasting. And a lot of that were car dealerships, which is good. The other thing was gas stations, and that's mostly because the price of gas is going up. But if you even take those out, it was pretty broad-based. There are 13 categories of retailers that the Commerce Department follows, and only one, and that's a category that lumps together hobby stores and bookstores and sporting goods stores, that was the only one that declined for the week. For the month. So that was good. But if you also look at the bigger trend, if you look at the year-to-year comparison on retail sales, it was up 3.6% from March of 2018, which is good, and it's, you know, positive and it's forward, but it's below the 4.3% that we have as sort of a long-term average for that. So the retail numbers, like a lot of the numbers that we're seeing these days, are showing us that the economy is continuing to grow, but maybe at a bit of a slower pace. The Federal Reserve Board came out this week with its Beige Book, which is sort of an anecdotal look around the country at the region by region at how the economy is doing. And the Fed said, you know, we're looking at kind of a moderate growth pace, that we're not going great guns, but we're going. And one of the things that came up was what you mentioned before, is the uncertainty over trade issues. And, you know, as Adam said, I mean, if you take that off the table, maybe that's going to help things more.
We got some data from manufacturing, industrial production, capacity utilization, I think pointing to much the same. The economy certainly isn't falling apart. We're certainly not headed for the recession, but at the same time, you know, not the kind of growth that we would have expected there, perhaps.
Right, Kyle. One of the things that we looked at in those numbers is the capacity utilization, and that rate sort of shows us the inflation that's in the pipeline, because as, you know, manufacturers and utility companies and mining companies, as they get to a point where they're running out of capacity, they're going to have to start, you know, raising prices and passing those costs along to increase capacity. But we continue to be below the long-term capacity utilization rate average. In fact, the last time we hit that average was in April of 2008. So it's been a while. And, you know, this is, again, a repeating story that, you know, we hear concerns about inflation, yet we're really not seeing it perk up that much.
And I'm always struck, you know, the weight of the industrial machine that is the U.S. economy is not as significant as it once was, with so much of the employment transitioning to service-based, with so much of, you know, the weight of the S&P, for example, being now in technology stocks. And, of course, you know, this week we got two more technology IPOs out today, actually on Thursday. We've got a bunch more in the pipeline. It seems to be a pretty big year for kind of new issues, and especially some of the stuff that, you know, maybe historically we might have looked a little bit less favorably on, because you're talking about, you know, a company like Lyft or Uber, for example, where they're losing hundreds of millions of dollars a year. You know, it's rare. We had the rare one today with Zoom, where they're actually making a little bit of money. And most of these technology stocks, as they come to market, are actually losing money. But what's interesting in all this is that these are businesses that for a long time investors knew about. They often were utilizing, you know, a company like Uber or Lyft, and yet they couldn't access them. And so I think, you know, while we don't get a lot of clients that are asking, hey, should I be buying this stock, we get the occasional investor who's concerned about that. And I don't know, Mark, Adam, if you've got any thoughts on kind of where to head with some of that stuff, but certainly...
I do. Don't buy an IPO right after it comes out. You know, companies, they go through this whole roadshow just to build up hype for the shares. There's a lot of hype when it initially brought to market. So if you're interested in any of those shares, wait till all of the hype dies down months from now before you sit down and consider anything like that.
Yeah, you know, you take a look at Lyft. It opened at just over $87 a share. It peaked immediately at $88 a share and change, and now it's at $58 and change. So any investor, to your point, Adam, who just couldn't wait to get their hands on Lyft IPO and jumped in right at the beginning, just got squashed. So, be careful when it comes to IPOs. If it's a good company, there's plenty of time to buy into it.
Yeah, always opportunity. I think safe for investors to go back to basics on this. Remember that asset allocation explains 90% of the variability of your portfolio returns. And so how much of a difference can adding that one great stock really, really add, especially when you consider that the price you're getting it for might not be the price it ultimately settles at. And I think the one other piece in all this for investors to remember is that in an indirect way, you may be participating in some of these IPOs long before they go to market. There's a number of mutual funds out there, a few that we use pretty regularly and that we look at pretty regularly that, you know, hold shares of Uber and Lyft before they went public, that hold shares of SpaceX and Allbirds, if you know the Allbirds shoe company. There are mutual fund investors out there. There are mutual fund portfolio managers who are buying that stuff, putting in a portfolio that you might already own. So that's something to keep in mind as well, is you might already have a little bit of exposure. And if all you want is to know that you're participating, you know, maybe that's enough. Well, that's the end of yet another Money Talk. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.